Everybody's Talking is not just the premise of this podcast and pretty much any other podcast that you've ever listened to. It's also the name of the hit song we're breaking down on today's That Song from That Movie. Hey!
What's wrong,
kid?
With you?
Oh, wow. I really didn't know which ones you were going to go for there. I was going to get DW.
Also good.
Thank you for joining That Song from That Movie, the journey through the very best and worst of movie songs. I am your salami-stealing host, Dietrich, and joining us is the best-looking cowboy in the whole parade, Alex.
Which parade is this?
The best-looking cowboy parade.
Oh, wow.
Well done, Alex.
You won the best-looking cowboy at the best-looking cowboy parade, Alex. Come on.
Well, I mean, that's an achievement.
I've seen you with those rootin' tootin' boots on.
Shh. We don't tell everybody about that.
And completing the lineup is the man who probably hit the roof with excitement when he realised that song from that movie legend John Barry composed this movie, Ben.
Oh, you've ruined one of my greatest facts.
I didn't know
he won a Grammy for this movie.
A Grammy. Where did he go for research this time? We'll find out later.
I mean, it was just New York, you know. It's not a bad one. It was just some Warholian party.
I would like to know, in the past fortnight, what have you been watching?
Cha-cha-cha.
As people on our Twitter feed will know, I've been to see Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse.
I have also seen the Spider-Verse film.
What did you think?
Yeah, I thought it was great. It was only about 20 minutes before the end that I realised, oh wait, this is another one.
Yeah.
I did not know there was going to be another one.
It's definitely caught a lot of people by surprise. I already knew that it was a part one because they announced it as part one and part two and then changed the name of part two.
Oh.
They need to. This is the problem of the Planet of the Apes films, though. The films are too named too similarly. Can you tell me what order the Planet of the Apes films comes?
Planet of the Apes first.
Rise of the Planet of the Apes. Oh, right. Okay. Sorry about those new ones.
Yeah, no, but it's right. Is it Rise, Dawn, War?
Yep. Yeah.
Is that what it is? Yeah.
Yeah, but it should have been Dawn, Rise. No, it should have been Dawn, War, Rise, or something like that.
But it's just like, it's just Dawn of the Rise of the Planet.
There's so many of this.
Calling it Into the Spider-Verse. What's this one? Across the Spider-Verse?
Yeah, the next one's Beyond the Spider-Verse.
Yeah, see, I don't like that.
Well, the reason why I was going to go first is because I mentioned on Twitter that I got into an argument in the cinema with somebody, and I would tell the story on this podcast.
In the cinema?
Yes. Well, it's about cinema etiquette.
Oh, what were you doing?
Well, what was I doing? I wasn't doing anything.
What were they doing?
Essentially, they had the phones out in the cinema.
Oh, bad.
Yeah, so they had the phones out during the production bit at the beginning, which is, I mean, it's still not great, but whatever, fine, whatever. Then 5 minutes later, they got their phones out again. And I thought, that's it. If I do it one more time, I'm going to say something. And yeah, less than a minute later, they had their phones out again, scrolling TikTok, I think it was. And I said, can you put your phone away, please? To which they very wittily responded, I didn't realise my mum was in the cinema.
Nice.
Whoa.
Nice. She got you.
And this girl's boyfriend leant over to me and said, why are you saying she was on a phone? I was like, because she was on a phone and she's put it away now. So that's why I said it. To which he said, well, if you're so confident she was on the phone, who was she on the phone to?
Well,
I was like,
who was she on the phone to? Spoiler, it was Alex.
I just went, how the fuck would I know? And he went, whatever, fuck off. And he sat stewing and staring at me the entire film whilst
Nice.
Very much made a point of like laughing heartily at every joke. Like, I'm not bothered by what you did, but really, I was only thinking about that.
That's annoying.
You were sweating internally.
He was. If you can pay attention to a film, that is probably the most visually stimulating, in fact, just all senses stimulating thing you have ever seen. You're a slave to the dopamine hypothesis. Your brain has been warped by TikTok and you are cooked, my friend.
Why even go to the cinema?
Yeah, like 1 minute into the film or so.
Oh, that is awful.
Yeah. I still don't really have a good response to who was she on the phone to. Like, what am I supposed to say to that?
You should have said her boyfriend.
Ooh.
Oh, that would have been a good answer.
Probably would have ended in a fight, D.
Yeah, you probably would have done. Like when the movie ended, I knew already they didn't have a post. This isn't a spoiler. A post or mid-credit sequence. So when it finished, I stood up very slowly. I checked for my keys and my phone, my wallet. Very like, I don't care. This is a normal day for me, kind of thing. And then slowly walked off, and I could see him like sat in his chair staring at me, and I thought, I've won this. I've actually won this battle.
How many times have you rethought this over during your showers?
It dominated all of my thoughts for like the next week or so after I saw it.
Yep. You've won it many times in your head.
I mean, what I want to know, D, is when you said it, did everyone in the room stand up and applaud?
No, because I would have then said, can you stop applauding, please?
Yes, I mean, that would have been the greatest ending to all.
Lovely.
It's a good film, though.
Yeah, it is a good film. Yeah. It is a good film. Alex, can you balance this out by one of your usual, like, Guernsey Potato Peel Pie Society films?
Well, so, have you guys seen the film The Triangle of Sadness?
I have, yes.
I haven't, no.
What do you think of it?
An absolutely awesome film.
Did you? I did enjoy it. I thought there were some bits which made my stomach turn a bit.
Oh, okay,
yeah, I know you were on about it. So yes, exactly. Yeah,
well,
yeah.
I mean, one scene in particular. But what a weird film, though. Like, yeah, it's, it really, you know, is what? Weird. It was an experience in the sense that I went in not knowing anything.
Oh, you saw the cinema?
No, I saw it last week on Prime, I think.
It's on
one of the services. Yeah, but I didn't know anything about it, and it just goes to places you just do not expect. And, like, it starts off a very different film to how it ends. Let's just put it that way. I enjoyed it a lot. Would recommend it.
Yeah, he's got a few films, that guy, that, what's his name, Robin Osland, that you probably enjoy.
He did Force Majeure, didn't he?
He did Force Majeure, yeah, and The Square's really good as well.
I've not seen that one.
But yeah, Triangle of Sadness is probably his best.
Yeah, I mean, it was nominated for Best Picture, wasn't it? But I remember at the time, at the Oscars, I think. Not sure what this is, or, I haven't seen anything about it, but having watched it, deserved. Such a weird film.
Yeah, it should have won.
Yeah, well, maybe not, but it's I'd check it out if you have a free evening.
Alex balances out with our mainstream muck.
I also did watch Officer and Gentleman, which I think we should cover on this podcast, because what? And also a really crazy film.
For this episode, join us as we take the Midnight Express for some cowboy action, where everybody's talking from Midnight Cowboy. So to find out what was happening in the world when the movie came out...
My nose is bleeding.
Time for some history.
It's been a while since we've been back this far. Mm. Midnight Cowboy came out in June 1969 in the UK. So I went back to look at some facts of the time. This one caught my eye, actually. There was a documentary called The Royal Family, played on BBC One, and it is the all-time viewership record in England. It attracted more than half the population of the country watched it, which is over 30 million people at the time, just to watch a documentary on the Royals.
It's why Ricky Tomlinson is such a national...
I wondered who would make the joke. Four fucking two.
I was thinking more tonight on Gogglebox.
Continue, Ben, sorry.
I will do. So also, that ended the last episode of the original Star Trek season, finished airing. D, do you know what the episode is?
No. Best of One World.
Close. I didn't know what it was. I was hoping you would say it. There was also a very, very famous actress died. Someone we will get round to covering, I'm sure, on this podcast. Judy Garland died at the incredibly young age of 47 after an accidental overdose. There's probably quite a few films she performs in which we could cover. Obviously, the big one at some point we'll have to get round to is The Wizard of Oz.
We did talk about it briefly.
Have we done a Judy Garland?
Well, we did. We did Star is Born, didn't we? And I think it came up.
Oh, right. Yes.
Because we talked about the other versions.
True. She did come up.
She did get a mention.
Have you seen the Judy film?
Yes.
What did you think of it? I thought it was pretty naff.
Yeah, I think...
She was good. Renee Zellweger was good.
Yeah, it came out around the same time as that film Stan and Ollie, which the Steve Coon film with John C. Reilly. And they were very similar. They had like a very similar storyline and vibe. And I think that was a better film. I mean, obviously not good at songs in it in the same way.
It also had Newcastle, bits of Newcastle randomly in it, which I know.
It did. I thought the Judy film was okay. I didn't think it was anything more than that.
A much better film we are discussing today, though. I hope everyone is in agreement, because we are talking about Midnight Cowboy. So this film, an American drama, was released in 1969, directed by John Schlesinger and starring likes of Dustin Hoffman and John Voight. This one is based on the novel of the same name, in which the film focuses on Voight's Joe Buck, what a name, convinced of his irresistible appeal to women. He quits his job and heads from Texas to New York, thinking he can latch on to some rich dowager. However, New York is not the glitz and glam he imagines it to be, and Joe soon finds himself living in an abandoned building with a Dickensian layabout of sorts, Rizzo Razzo, played by Dustin Hoffman. Absolutely fantastically played by Dustin Hoffman. The two form a rough and ready friendship, a very interesting relationship that covers both the highs and lows of each of their lives. What do you guys think of this film first before I talk about it?
You made it sound like you were just going to give us a lecture or an essay once we've given our opinions. I'm going to talk about it for several hours.
I could.
I think it's probably one of the best films ever made.
Wow, that's even bigger. Good.
I think it is. I mean, we watched all of the Oscar Best Pictures, and this was one of the first, because we started in 65, Dustin, like we just did. I think it was because it was 52 weeks until, so we could watch one a week anyway. So this was one of the first ones we watched, and it was like, well, if this is the standard, then this is going to be great. And unfortunately, they did get worse. This was a peak. Especially considering the film after this one, I think, was Patton, which was quite a significant drop-off.
That's an interesting film.
Yeah, maybe. It's probably one of the most heartbreaking endings to a film I think I've seen. But I think just the whole thing just... I can't even really explain it other than it's a very emotional ride. I think you feel very connected to everything that's happening on a very visceral level, if that's the right word. Yeah. It just hits you in all the right places. And I think it feels like a very true story. And I think probably is quite evocative of the 60s in that they were moving from this place, especially in America, like moving from this place of more like clean cut. I guess obviously there's that direct thing that he's like a cowboy, so referencing kind of that Wild West past, but the world is very much that he enters in this film is very, very different. There's such like a naivety to his character and an innocence. And it's funny because he's going there to be a prostitute, to be a male prostitute.
Yeah, he's going there to be a gigolo in here.
Yeah, but it's kind of like he goes there with such optimism and it's like so quickly crushed.
It is, isn't it? It's almost interesting. It's almost like a childish bravado. Yeah. Like he's so brazenly confident.
You know, there's a slight high towards the end, maybe, where things seem to could be about to turn, and then that quickly, again, is crushed. But, I don't really know how to put into words why it's so good, other than you have to kind of experience it, but it feels like it is like it's like an emotional experience.
Oh, yeah. I think that shift as well, when you talked about the cowboy, is also like this film is influential in cinema for that comparison, like going from, I guess, the dominant Western, which is probably the 40s and 50s, maybe in the 30s, and then even like skipping film noir, which is kind of like a, even though it's often like grim and gloomy, it's still got like a sheen to it, like everyone's cool and, you know, calm, and everyone's talking with these fantastic one-liners. This is just grim. This is reality. This is like the 60s are in now. You know, we've got all the films like that are quite eye-opening. You know, Mean Streets coming out soon in the 70s. We've had things like Straw Dogs, really like open, gritty movies. And this is a different side to that, more of a pulled back. There's no action, there's no like in your face, it's just letting things breathe, and like this is actually what New York is like. It's not the Times Square beauty that you see on TV. Like Times Square in this film looks absolutely hideous.
It's funny, like the cinematic representation of New York, because I think you have this film and you have French Connection, which I think is a few years later, which very kind of similar, like gritty vibe. But then you kind of have Annie Hall, which I think is late 70s.
Yeah, I think it's a bit further on.
Which sort of changes that view of New York to be...
It's like an ode to New York, that.
Yeah, and you get that kind of shift in how it's portrayed probably from that point onwards.
Yeah, probably.
Whereas, yeah, they really drill down on, like, the griminess, the sleaze of it in this.
Yes, it feels very dirty.
Yeah, it feels very dirty. I mean, Dickensian in London, it feels like a neo-Dickensian kind of place.
Rizzo Razzo is the Fagin. Dee, you've just seen this for the first time recently. What do you think?
Yeah, I think my initial thought as the credits roll of this movie is that it goes into that special category of movies called, yeah, that was amazing, but I'm probably never going to watch that again.
Oh, yeah.
the kind of film, I put my example here as 12 Years a Slave, where it's like, I don't think I can emotionally go through that film again.
Moonlight. Mm-hmm. Moonlight.
Oh, yeah. There's a whole category of those films, isn't it?
Yeah. It was very interesting what was happening, story-wise and technically, but the output is just so bleak. I never felt comfortable watching the movie, but I felt compelled to keep watching, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
I was shocked to find out that this movie came out in the 60s because the subject matter and the way it's shot and the way it's edited feels, like with its random cuts and zooms and like bits with like gradients and stuff like that, it almost feels like it's from that 80s new wave of directors.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's just so interesting to look at, but at the same time, always felt uneasy.
Yeah, this film is ahead of its time in so many ways.
Like the framing of shots would feel off, or you'd have like a steady, for lack of a better term, movie-like section, then suddenly the camera's wobbling like I'm walking down the street right next to them, right there in that dank, dirty New York street, right in the scene. It simply just never let me settle for more than 30 seconds.
Yeah.
I mean, it added to an overall sense of trepidation and intrigue for the movie, which I really hope was by design, because if not, I've just waffled on about something which was only a happy accident for the director.
I think there's everything John Schlesinger, in his autobiography, he was one of those directors who said that everything, all the mood, all the emotion that you're wanting to connote should come across before even anyone's spoken. Like, the screenplay is not as important as the setup.
Yeah, the sense of trepidation in this film is palpable.
Yes. And like that he's big, you know, like the amount of times that Joe Buck's looking in the mirror, and that, like, it's reflecting back on himself. So, like, sometimes he's, you know, he's doing his hair, admiring himself. Sometimes it's the questioning, look what you've just done, you know, after he's beaten someone up or, had an intimate relationship which he didn't feel quite comfortable with. And it's constantly the reassessing himself of who am I, just... And that's, there's no words. It's sometimes him just staring at the camera through the mirror. And that's, you know, that's incredibly clever.
Yeah, and I think that sort of looking into the mirror stuff as well also creates that element of, I don't know if what I'm seeing is actually what happened or just how Joe is seeing it. It reminds me a bit of like American Psycho, where you don't really know which scenes are the real scenes and which scenes like the ideological, nicer ones in Patrick Bateman's head.
Yeah, Brazil, the film Brazil, if you've seen Brazil, does it a lot as well, of the, like, looking in through reflections and not knowing what's true in reality. So it looks like someone's just looking in a mirror, but you don't know if that's a reflection back at themselves or it's like, because it's at a slight angle, they're looking at something else. You could dissect this film forever. The acting performances are absolutely fantastic. John Voight is a slab of a man, but he is fantastic in this. He didn't win an Oscar for this, but he went on to win an Oscar later. I think Dustin Hoffman was nominated, but he has his own Oscars. I think he's such a fantastic actor, Dustin Hoffman. I think it's probably watered down because he hasn't done loads in the past 20 years, probably, that are of merit. But God, he made a lot of great films. And actually, I think he took a huge risk making this film. Like, he'd just done The Graduate, was like the darling of Hollywood, and everyone was telling him, don't do this film. It's like, it's grim, it's career suicide. And he actively campaigned to be put in the film. Which is, I think is great. Is a great representation of Dustin Hoffman, of what he wanted to put across.
Definitely.
So the biggest fact of this film and the most famous, well-known fact is that this is the first and only ever X-rated movie to win an Oscar, which at the time, a X-rating film was mostly reserved for pornographic films. Now, there are a lot of sexual scenes in the film. There are a lot of sexual narratives. The discussion between, the Warholian party, which involves a lot of, I guess, the modern-day equivalents of people from the LGBTQ community, which is why we say the film is far ahead of its time. And actually, this film was really seminal in shifting or making a new rating, making what is now known as the R rating. So this film came out in 69. In 71, the R rating came out. So, and apparently the response to this film was hugely influential in that, because a lot of movie theatres refused to show Midnight Cowboy for the impact it had, not just the Oscars, like it was a film that did very, very well. And we'll go on to talking about that when we talk about the music. It was hugely impactful. And I don't know what you guys think, but because it doesn't really happen nowadays, but that, you know, when you ban something, it becomes more popular. Like The yeah. Exorcist, you know, that was the fame of, you know, don't go see this film, it's causing problems. But famous,
is it
you
the Mary Whitehouse effect?
I don't know. I don't know. I wonder if that was what this is, because I guess a lot of people just saw the X rating, thought this is a pornographic movie, and just didn't show it.
Yeah, it's weird because it wouldn't be X-rated now, would it? Well, it wouldn't have anywhere near the rating that it has now. But
interesting. I wonder what the rating is now.
Yeah, it probably is an 18 in this country.
I think it was an 18.
Yeah. So interestingly, John Schlesinger, I think it was after Midnight Cowboy, he came out as being gay. So I think it was much later. So he was in his, I think, his 60s by that time, but never felt like it was comfortable that he could. But a lot of people said that they just saw him as he was filming this film, and like it was getting to him. Like John Voight talks about something in documentary that he had to like, Schlesinger was about like having a panic attack, like he was whiting out, and he had to talk about how influential John Voight thought the film was, and that kind of brought him out. And John Schlesinger kept talking about, we're really making something influential here, and he could feel that as he was making it. And you can say that's like an egotistical thing, but I think he saw that himself in the film in a lot, because it's not obvious for how sexuality is so prominent in the film what the sexuality of the characters are.
Mm.
There's a lot of conflict and a lot of discussion of whether Joe Buck is gay or bisexual. It's so just alluded to and implied, and allows you to just kind of like, well, I guess be fluid in the idea, you know, which again is incredibly modern, way ahead of its time.
Well, it's ironic you say that it's modern, because that sort of added to my theory that the relationship between Ratso and Joe Buck was very George and Lenny from Of Mice and Men.
Oh, really? That's interesting.
Because you have like the shorter, mentally tougher, streetwise, street-talking leader with their taller, physically stronger, slightly dimmer, and potentially, but never outrightly confirmed, homosexual follower. Yep. Yep. And it even ends with somebody dying at the end in just a very sad way.
Well, yeah, the other way. Oh, that is so sad that I can't even talk about it. It's just so sad. And they're going off to Florida. Mm. Dee, did you notice that this is voted as one of the greatest film lines of all time? I'm walking here. It's from this film.
I knew it was from this film, yes.
One of the most famous lines used in every... This is where it starts. That is, you know, number 27 in the AFI's greatest movie quotes.
Every single depiction of New York will have somebody saying this.
Yeah, it will always have someone. I mean, yeah, it probably existed far before, but the Dustin Hoffman, Ritz Erazzo, I'm walking here, influential. So yeah, the last thing I'll say about the film before we talk about the music is John Schlesinger wanted the film to be equal parts tragedy and filled with compassion. He didn't just want it to be bleak. Now, that's what we've spoken about before, but do you guys feel that compassion coming through? We talked about the ending, but is there heart to the film? This is going to be important when we come to talk about the song, because apparently that's not really in the book. I don't know if you've read the book, Alex, or
no.
Didn't even ask me.
Well, I the literature boffin, I'll ask him.
I mean, I think for me in the film, it does, the compassion, I think the warmth of the two characters is definitely there.
Yes.
Between each other especially.
Mm-hmm.
But I think like the dignity of the Rizzo character really elevates it out of that bleakness, because he's idealistic in a lot of ways, isn't he? And their hope to kind of make it to Florida kind of gives you something to hold on to for the full film, that there might be something good that comes out of it in the end. And I guess it kind of does in some ways, that they form this friendship, but obviously then that is kind of severed, unfortunately, at the end.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's there. Definitely. And I think that's what allows you to be able to watch the film. Because I think if that wasn't in there, it would be a very uncomfortable, difficult ride, more so than it already is.
Yeah, it's like a nugget of hope in the film.
Yeah. And like you said, we'll come on to the music, which I think kind of does embody those two sides.
Absolutely.
I think for me, it definitely does come across, and I think it's probably what makes it bearable in some ways. Like I said, the ending to this film, I think, is just so poignant. it's just so painful to watch.
And done so well.
Yeah. That part where he kind of says thank you, and then it kind of moves over to John Voight, who's talking like about all these things that they can kind of start doing when they're down there, and they can move away from the life they had before. And then it sort of just pans back to his lifeless face, and it's just like, ooh.
But they let him go. They let him carry on going. But that driver's pretty nice.
Yeah.
Because he could just get throw him off. It's like, you know, there's nothing we can do other than keep him going.
Yeah, well.
Before we go on to talk about the song, I do just want to mention, obviously, we talked about John Barry. Fantastic. Composed the score. Won a Grammy. Best instrumental theme.
Legend of the podcast. That's his biggest accolade.
Yeah. The musical motif of this film, though, the harmonica by Toots Thielemann, is fantastic.
Mm.
That harmonica piece is brilliant. And I know we don't, you know, we don't mention it much, sort of non-lyrical music on this, but wow, that is absolutely incredible. Just fits the tone so well. But yes, let's move on to talk about today's focus, which is the song Everybody's Talking. Talking, no G. I feel like, what's his name? Steve Wright there.
Steve Wright in the afternoon. Love songs.
Yep.
Steve Wright. Love songs.
Sunday love songs, not in the afternoon.
Oh yeah, sorry, Steve. It's two different things.
So Everybody's Talking was initially written and performed by Fred Neil, but the version we are focusing on today is the one used in Midnight Cowboy, which is that by Harry Nilsson. Before we go into some facts, this song, the Harry Nilsson version, what do you think of it? Both its just thoughts on the song itself and then its use in the film. So it comes up very early on in the film, almost a credit song, yeah. An opening credit song.
Well, I think it's great, yeah. I think it's fantastic. It's sort of like a weird, strange sense of hope within the song, which I think helps really get you in the mood for the film and the way it's used with Justin walking. It sets the film on the right tone straight away.
Yeah,
it couldn't probably be more perfect because it really does capture that optimism, but also being a bit melancholy at the same time. And I think, like, you have that sense of being lost, I think, comes across, which is essentially what he is for the most of part of the film, the Joe Buck character, in that there's a lot of noise around, but you're kind of trying to do your own thing, but then soon those voices will kind of corrupt, I guess. And I think that's kind of what it demonstrates. And you kind of have, it's just a really good juxtaposition of having that really pacey kind of like almost country sound, but then bringing in those sort of softer, yeah, more melancholy lyrics. And it just really sums up the film perfectly. You kind of have those,
yes.
You have that Western influence musically, but then that East, that kind of, I guess, that what ends up being the sort of the griminess of New York coming through in the lyrics, almost, not quite, but yeah, leading to that sense of sadness.
Yeah, 100%. And actually, when we're going to talk about some of the history of this song, I think it'll add an extra layer onto its meaning for you. So that's why I asked you to think about it now, because I'm going to drop some knowledge. So the original song was first recorded by Fred Neil. So this was in 1966, so 3 years before Midnight Cowboy. So it comes from Fred Neil's second self-titled album, Fred Neil. Now, he is an interesting, infamous US folk singer of the 60s and 70s. He wrote a lot of songs which other artists became quite well known for performing. He himself, though, it was a personal choice to not perform. He did not like touring. Actually, from a lot of things I've read, he was quite anxious about going away from home. He was someone who basically found his enjoyment came from where he was. It wasn't through trying to achieve things or trying to make it in the music industry. That wasn't something he came along and discovered early in his life. It was more later on. Interestingly, he retired from music very early. And what I found out was, he basically lived off the royalties of this song in particular. And for much of the decades, I think almost 30 years, leading up to his death in 2001, he was involved in the preservation of dolphins. That was the main thing that he did, completely separate from the music industry.
Good now, for him.
The song Everybody's Talking had a lot of parallels to Neil's end of his musical career, and also similar to the life of Joe Buck in Midnight Cowboy. He discovered, as he was writing it, and he was actually asked to write this song, and he wrote it in one day and performed it in one take. So the version that I've given to you to perform is just one take, and that's it. And then the recording studio was in a different state, and he was feeling quite anxious, and he just wanted to get home, so he just rushed it and left. So he rushed wrote this song. This song that has had this impact was rush wrote. When he was asked about it, and it's not often, it was that he discovered that the success in his profession isn't all it's cracked up to be, and he just wanted to retreat. So actually, even though in Midnight Cowboy, it's about how the song's used at the start of Joe Buck seeing his kind of homespun Texan life as, you know, I just can't deal with this and I'm wanting to get to New York, you know, that's where the happiness will come, you know, the sailing on summer breeze, all the positive parts of the song. When actually Fred Neil is looking at how it's used almost at the end of the film, and that side of that's not all it's cracked up to be. Sometimes the beauty is almost what we had at the start, and that we're chasing things that we think we want, when actually it, the laid back life is, you know, the sailing on summer breeze. It's kind of him looking out, looking over the ocean. He lived in Florida. That's just what he wanted. And he lived most of his life and died in Florida. That's where they're going in the film. For me, that gives it this feeling of almost it fulfills the promise of the speaker in the song. It's rejecting fame to live your life in relative obscurity.
Hmm. Yeah, it was like a wistful feeling to it.
Yeah,
it's this that Joe Buck is, you know, he's gone through the, he was sold by the glitz and glam of the New York life. It wasn't what he's cracked up to be, and maybe the life that he had before is fine. And he was hoping to share it with someone else, but that wasn't always cracked up to be.
Hmm.
I linked you the Fred Neil version. What do you think of that one, if you were able to listen to it?
I mean, it's relative for people who haven't heard both versions. It's relatively similar.
Relatively, yeah.
Yeah, but I think it doesn't have the same optimism that's kind of put on it in the film version, because it lacks that kind of, it lacks that sort of country vibe, I think, doesn't it? It lacks that sort of warmth in the music. It sounds more generally melancholy.
That's interesting. I'd almost say it's too country, because it's got that drawl into his voice.
Well, maybe that's almost what it is, yeah.
I think Harry Nilsson, we're going to talk about Harry Nilsson, he brought a lot more contemporary skill to it.
Yeah, maybe that's it. It's more like pop country versus like blues country, I suppose.
Yeah.
But it's equally good. I think I liked both versions a lot. But I can see why the version that's in the film is the version that's used, because it does feel more, that there is more optimism in it. So there's a bit more, it brings the warmth to the film that they desperately needs in order to counterbalance the grimness.
Yeah, the Fred Neil version wouldn't have worked, in my opinion.
No.
What do you think, D?
I prefer the Nilsson version.
Yep.
It feels more like a purer performance, so it feels like there's more layers to uncover compared to Fred Neil's, which feels more like a straight-up performance of a song. Like, it's certainly a good performance of a song, but I feel like it's lacking the something that makes the Nilsson one work. That one feels like a pure performance of somebody actually going through that, whilst the other one feels like somebody performing a song. I don't know, I kind of get lost in Nilsson's version, where I don't with Fred Neil's.
It was one take. The Fred Neil version was one take, it was done.
I guess that's all I've had to tell you.
And in fact, actually, it leads quite nicely. You've led me very beautifully, Dion, to Harry Nilsson's version. Because Harry Nilsson's first job before he got into music, he was a computer programmer at a bank. And he became really fixated and focused. And in a way, that's kind of what he's known for. So a very famous singer, pioneering like musical experimentation. So he was very, very prominent in one of the pioneers of vocal overdubbing. So layered vocals, things like this, which he uses in this song. You know, his multiple layers of the song. The stuff that the Fred Neil version doesn't have. And I think that's what you guys were alluding to. Like, it gives something extra. You know, it's almost like he's pre-recorded it, then over-recorded it, then re-recorded it, and constantly, like, tinkering away at it and adding stuff to it. And that's what one of the things that made Harry Nilsson famous, not just his singing and songwriting capabilities, which have become very, very worshipped and well known.
Yeah, I think that makes sense, because I think like the warmth maybe comes from the richness of the sound of the voice, because there is more layers on top of each other rather than just that pure, just single take performance in the other version.
I think that's exactly it. But interestingly, actually, Harry Nilsson, as famous as he became in the sort of early 70s, starting off, basically this song catapulted him. He was someone that also didn't like touring. He never attended major public concerts. He has gone down, you know, much more than Fred Neil in the sort of musical zeitgeist of the time. Rolling Stones put him as 62 in their 100 greatest songwriter list back in 2015. He has a rep. So Fred Neil version was recorded in 66. In 67, Harry Nilsson was looking for a song to record. He was pointed to Everybody's Talking, and he added it to his second album, Aerial Bullet. Fantastic name for an album, which came out in 68. But now, Harry Nilsson, I've just had to throw this in, completely unrelated to the movie. Harry Nilsson has an album called Nilsson Schmilsson.
No, he doesn't.
He does. He does. Nilsson, he does. Schmilsson. He has an album called Nilsson Schmilsson and Son of Schmilsson. Seventh studio album by American singer Harry Nilsson. Nilsson Schmilsson. Wow. Fantastic, isn't it? If there's something, listeners, that you take away from this episode, please let it be that. So when the song was initially released before Midnight Cowboy, it did poorly. Didn't even make it on the Billboard Hot 100, which is really interesting when you think of the impact it's had now. John Schlesinger approached Nilsson to do a song for Midnight Cowboy. It was not his first choice. His first choice was a Bob Dylan song. So Bob Dylan had a song called Lay Lady Lay, which he didn't finish in time. And John Schlesinger just wanted to move on. He wanted the song kind of quite early on. I don't know if you've heard that song.
Yeah, I did listen to it. Wasn't a fan.
Lay, 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 lay.
No, I it works. Like, lyrically, it works with the same sort of feelings, but it just doesn't. To me, it's nowhere near. Like we said, the Harry Nilsson's version of Everybody's Talking combines so many feelings that are in the film. This didn't do the same. Other songs considered was Randy Newman's Cowboy. We've got to talk about Randy Newman every so often on this podcast.
Every so often, every other week.
This is before he kind of developed his slow drawl.
Yeah, I didn't recognise it was him.
I actually quite like this song.
I thought it was okay, yeah.
I wasn't expecting what I heard,
yeah,
which is a positive thing.
Yeah.
It's funny they didn't use it for Toy Story, though.
And Randy Newman's got a song called Cowboy and they've never used it.
Yeah, which I find weird.
This actually would work, you know, in a very sort of Sarah McLachlan way.
Thank God there's another Toy Story coming out.
Ooh.
Oh, please, you've ruined it for me.
Well, it's giving us something to do for next year.
No, I'm feeling sad. So Harry Nilsson originally offered a different song for this film. So he offered a song called I Guess the Lord Must Be in New York City, for obvious reasons. If you've heard the song, it almost sounds like it's going to be the same song when it starts.
It sounds the same. It sounds yes. like the same song.
It does, doesn't yeah. it?
My first thought was it really could fit in the film, and then I had the realisation that it's pretty much the same song.
It yeah, would fit basically. Because it does.
It is. It's almost the same. But John Schlesinger actually asked for one of his earlier songs from his second album, which was Everybody's Talking. And, you know, as they say, the rest is history.
History.
It was interesting, actually, reading some clips from his autobiography. There were studio executives telling John Schlesinger that if they cleaned up this film a bit, it would be a great vehicle for Elvis Presley.
In 69?
As well. We're not just talking about Presley singing, we're talking about Presley acting. He wanted to play the role of Joe Buck.
I mean,
the vibe of the movie would have been very different.
Like, we're talking, this must be late in Elvis's career as well, because I'm thinking most of his like films, like Blue Hawaii, what's the, was that the 50s?
If we say late in Elvis's career, he's probably still on like 28 or something.
probably.
That's the weird thing about Elvis.
How things could have been different.
I don't think he doesn't have the naivety that John Voight has in this film, I don't think. I mean, maybe he could play out, I mean, I don't know what Elvis's range is like.
Yeah, he could have had the accent. John Voight apparently really struggled with the accent.
Did he?
Yeah, because I think John Voight's got a New York kind of sensible accent. He has not got Texas. I mean, he sold me.
I thought it was, yeah, I didn't know, but we're not American, I suppose.
That is true.
After Midnight Cowboy was released, the single was re-released and it peaked at number 6. That's such a huge difference. A lot of the critical reception for the song is inherently linked to the themes of the movie. Every discussion of the song at the time talked about it in hand with Midnight Cowboy. And vice versa, actually, a lot of movie critics talk about one of the greatest things about the film is Everybody's Talking. I think William Mann, who did John Schlesinger's autobiography, said that one cannot imagine Midnight Cowboy without Everybody's Talking. And I was quite curious if you agree.
It's going to make movie or song hard at the end of the episode.
It is indeed. That's why we're building it up.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess we will come on to it at that point, but it is... Can you play this song? Dee, maybe thinking more about you, how aware of you were this song since you'd not seen the film?
Oh, well, I was fully aware of the song.
Yeah.
I listened to a lot of smooth radio. This has been well established on this podcast. but now it will always be connected to this film.
Yeah. Okay. That was my journey as well.
But previously, I had no connection to this. Mm-hmm. I didn't really see how it could fit, to be honest. And now I can't see it without it.
Does that elevate the song for you then?
Yeah, actually, I think
as someone that is just a smooth radio staple.
Yeah, I think it does elevate the song. Going back to that onion metaphor, it just adds another layer to the onion of this song.
Talk about onions. I am in another future episode of the podcast. Got a lot of layers.
God.
What do you think, Al?
Yeah, I'm in agreement. I think I went through the same journey. I knew the song before I watched the film. I didn't know this was the theme song to this film.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it just only makes you like the song more, associating it with the film, because it just gives it more depth. I think when a song is in a film, you do think more about how it fits. You maybe focus more on the lyrics than you would normally, because it's like you just hear the song, like, yeah, it's a nice song. And maybe actually you think, oh, it's been used here for a reason. Why is that? And maybe it just gets you thinking about it differently. I don't know. I think it definitely adds depth to it.
That's true. I mean, some people say that there's a few critics that say this is a staple of the classic rock era, that it's a great combination of, you know, feelings of a bit of strange melancholy, beauty. AFI is on their list number 20, you know, Midnight Cowboy does well, of the greatest movie songs of all time. Mm. That is not bad at all when you think of the catalogue of songs in what we're talking of 100 years of cinema. That is not bad. It is an absolutely stellar song.
Top five
time. We have had a string of talking about various cowboys. We've got a Midnight Cowboy here. We've had Woody a few times in the past, three times. But I'm curious, who are cinema's greatest movie cowboys?
Oh my God.
Now, this might be hard because many of these are old. But I've combined various lists from the internet, and I will definitely say that there is a recency bias in some of these films, and we're also stretching it at times. Number six, so we're just outside the list, is a ridiculous stretch, and I'm interested if any of you get it. So come on, give me the top five.
I'm not even sure I'm going to be able to name the cowboys. I mean, I could name films with cowboys, so I don't know, John Wayne in some film.
What film though, Alex, is number four?
True Grit.
No, number four is a film from 1956 starring John Wayne. If you could say the film, I'll let you off. Probably the greatest old-fashioned Western.
Paint Your Wagon.
No. It's an absolutely shocking film.
Wood is Pine. Is it the name of a state?
I'll let you off. So the film is The Searchers, which is absolutely fantastic.
Oh, The Searchers.
It's Ethan Edwards.
I've heard it, yeah. The good, the bad, and the ugly. Those guys.
Yes, the man with no name is number one. Yes, Clint Eastwood's Man with No Name.
Woody.
Woody is number five.
Is he? Wow, okay.
He is indeed.
Is the Midnight Cowboy in there? That would be a stretch.
No, he's not. He's not. I think he was in no lists that I looked at.
Owen Wilson's character in Shanghai Noon?
I was wondering if someone would mention it. It was not in any list, surprisingly.
Straight off the bat of that, obviously, Will Smith in Wild Wild West.
No, also not.
Owen Wilson in
Shanghai Nights.
Nope.
I was going to say Clint Eastwood, but in Unforgiven.
No other Clint Eastwoods.
Val Kilmer in Tombstone.
Yes, fantastic. Doc Holliday.
Butch Cassidy, Sundance Kid?
But not Butch Cassidy, no.
No?
No.
They're not in it?
No. It was in the top tens, but no.
God.
So you've got three so far. Two more.
Billy the Kid in Bill and Ted.
No. Oh, wait, you've got four, sorry. You only need one more. One more. Number two.
Oh.
This is a hard one. So this is a spaghetti western. Number two in almost every list. One and two were the same in almost every list.
Is it Lee Marvin in something?
It's not Lee Marvin, no, but it's not Million Miles.
Oh, no, it's the guy. Oh, God, what's his name? I watched that TV show Landscapers recently. Paul Newman.
No, it's not Paul Newman.
Is it not?
It's Charles Bronson. He plays harmonica in Once Upon a Time in the West, which is one of the greatest westerns. Number six is Boba Fett.
No.
Is he a cowboy?
Exactly. But he's in so many lists. One list must have, everyone's just copied it.
Cad Bane is the Star Wars cowboy.
Honorable mentions, Django. Yeah. The Lone Ranger.
Oh, what about, God, someone from Blazing Saddles. Billy the Kid from Blazing Saddles.
Shane.
Billy the Kid in something.
I think a few people were saying, they're not really cowboys, almost prefaced every single time they entered one of these.
Right, so now it's time to decide what we think is better, the movie or the song. So this week it's Everybody's Talking versus Midnight Cowboy. Alex, which one do you think is better?
I don't know if I can decide.
When was the last time we had a movie or song that was difficult?
Good question.
Generally swings movie way, but when it's been sung, it's been a huge song shift.
Yeah, I think it's happened before, hasn't it? But I feel like I don't want to decide on this one. I feel like it should be a deadlock because I always lean towards film because I think like it gives the song the prominence that it maybe didn't have before, which like we've already spoken about. When I like both, that's usually the way I lean. But I don't really want to in this case because I think that the song heightens the film as well. They both prop each other up significantly. And because of that, they're both elevated. So I think I'm not going to decide.
Oh, just the exact same reasoning. Like, it's like you've used, I will pick Midnight Cowboy. I think this song is absolutely fantastic. But I think it is elevated by the film. And it was literally elevated because it did nothing commercially and then did very, very well.
I'm following Ben
this
here.
This is such a historic film as well. It's such a, like, even narrative, interpersonal, what you're seeing on screen, it is a staple of, like, cinema, like, history. You know, the X-rated, the kind of shift that it resembled of the changing of the tides from movies from the, probably the 50s to, like Dee was saying, you know, the Brat Pack, the new directors coming in. No other film like this is from the 60s is like this.
Couldn't have put it better myself.
Insert someone in the Twitter comments telling me a list of films from the 60s that are exactly like this.
Yep.
Yeah, probably.
Oh, yeah. Thanks, Twitter.
So that brings to an end another episode of That Song from That Movie. Let us know which one you think is better, the movie or the song, on social media. So Twitter, Instagram, and Hive. Alex, what is our social media handle?
TSFTMPod.
Thank you. So you can also help the podcast by sharing this on a random subreddit. But Ben, what random subreddit should they share it on this week?
The Mandalorian.
Mm-hmm. Makes sense.
So you can also help the podcast by signing up to our Patreon, which now actually has an actual thing to unlock.
Yeah.
it's taken a while. You can buy our merch, tell your friends, or leave a 5-star review wherever you listen to your podcasts. All the links are in the show's notes. So all that's left now is to do some goodbyes. So it's goodbye from myself. Goodbye. And goodbye from Alex.
Bring me Peter Pan.
And goodbye from Ben.
Nilsson Schmilsson.
So goodbye, everybody. Bye.
Bye-bye. I'll try, yeah. Mr. Alvin.
I thought about going for 10 minutes to Wapner. Hey Ma, how about the cookie?
No dice.
No dice. No dice. It's 8 over.